saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of bagged concrete and mortar mixes, great for any project. Whether you're pouring a walkway, a concrete slab, or setting a post, view our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. You and me, we're at Coachella 2026 watching Cat's Eye perform, but we're not on stage. We're not in the artist area even. We're jammed into the crowd, half lit by someone else's iPhone flash. And somewhere in this sea of flower crowns and dusty sneakers beside you is Manon, the only Black member of Cat's Eye, the girl group Netflix told you was going to redefine global pop. She's here the same way that you are, as a spectator. She's not performing. She's watching a festival set. She was built in a lab to perform from the sidelines. If you've seen the Netflix Hybe show that created Cat's Eye, you know the version of Manon they sold you at first. The messy, magnetic girl with a lot of potential, framed as lacking the grit and discipline her bandmates supposedly had. The documentary cut her into an antagonist, almost. The camera loved her, the edit lingered on her tears, her wins, her missteps. She was the central point of tension throughout the story. When the final lineup was announced, she was, of course, announced last for dramatic effect, and what debuted was more than a girl group. It was supposed to be a sisterhood. Six girls sobbing in each other's arms who finally made it on a soundstage in LA, promising to spend the rest of their lives together, as if they hadn't just spent months being pitted against each other on camera for our entertainment like beautiful, glossy gladiators. Since then, you've watched that promise unravel in real time. A temporary hiatus for Manon to focus on her health, group activities meanwhile going on without her, pinky up as a quintet, Manon quietly removing Cat's Eye from her bio, fans constantly speculating about whether she was pushed from the group or if she jumped or whether she was ever meant to stay at all. The official story stops at "We support her" from Hybe, but the images say something else. The group moves forward as a five, while the Black girl who sold the dream as the face of the group is now a civilian in GA. There's a different story there. I've wanted to talk about girl group politics for a long time, and Manon is definitely the springboard for this story, but she's not the only character. Modern girl group machinery runs on two clashing myths: that everyone on stage is an equal sister, but also that one of them is secretly the chosen one and will become an amazing superstar soloist. Manon is walking a path that is older than she is, one that goes all the way back to the girl group as a manufactured product that contains both of these myths. Over the next 40 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about why those myths keep producing the same result. We'll look at Destiny's Child, Little Mix, The Spice Girls, Fifth Harmony, The Pussycat Dolls, and Sugar Babes, and map out the recurring roles that every girl group seems to have or slot into. The protagonist, the leader, the wild card, the glue, and the visual or the outlier. We'll also talk about how K-pop idol systems, like the one behind Cat's Eye, westernized for the first time, industrialized those roles, controlling the songs, the styling, the social media, even the performance of We're All Best Friends that you are expected to believe. In a system that needs a story to sell and multiple stars to sell it, someone always has to pay the price. Sometimes it's the obvious lead who finally leaves to go solo, sometimes it's the loud or the creative one who can't be contained by the rigidity of a girl group, but often it's the girl carrying the entire representational burden of being the Black one in a group designed by people who don't have to live with that and clearly don't care how it feels. In Cat's Eye, a lot of pressure ends up on Manon. She's the Black French-speaking visual in a K-pop-style experiment, portrayed as both the beating heart and its recurring problem, who has now abruptly been taken out of the frame while everything else keeps moving. The friendship myth has done and is doing what it needed to do for Cat's Eye. The group gets to present as fine while the brand rolls on with zero continuity issues. This video is about why this pattern keeps showing up over and over again. The need for a girl group to have a sacrificial lamb, and how when you understand the history of these archetypes and the myths, it's very hard to imagine a version of Cat's Eye where Manon specifically actually manages to make it out intact. Welcome to my channel, or welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I'm the Sociologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos about pop culture. You should subscribe. I'm showing up here every week, and I know you're coming back. You can listen to this episode as a podcast if you like. All my videos are now on audio platforms wherever you get your audio. And my podcast, Evolution of a Snake, is going on tour literally next week. There are mere days until we premiere our new show, The Showgirl Experience, in New York City. We are going across North America in May and June. Please go to evolutionofasnake.com to get tickets. We can't wait to see you. If you want to understand why certain girl groups almost never make it to the end credits of their story, you have to go back way earlier than the abrupt announcement of a member's departure. You have to return to the moment the group is formed, because that's where the script is being written. We think in extremes about authenticity when it comes to music, but to bands specifically. For bands, there's this romantic version of how they happened, where a bunch of friends start playing songs together purely for the love of the game, writing until they are miraculously discovered and transformed into superstars. Then there is the automatic suspicion that is applied to anything that isn't that organic narrative story, especially for the girl groups. Most of the time, it's assumed that girl groups are nothing more than products created by corporations. The reality is that I think there's a spectrum of control when it comes to the authenticity of a girl group, and there's a very specific question that can make or break their fortunes. What do these women think they are signing up for? Are they here to accomplish a collective mission, or are they here to act in someone else's play? Let's take a real-life example to illustrate this question. Little Mix is a rare instance of how neither of those extremes about authenticity can apply. If you don't know them, they are one of the most successful girl bands of all time, formed on the X Factor as prior soloists. In the hierarchy of pop star dreams, solo stardom is the most typical goal. It's all you, your voice, your name on the marquee, you making all of the decisions, theoretically. Their group was formed by the judges on the X Factor because they failed to see Jessie, Jay, Leanne, and Perry as viable solo artists. It stung at first. They've said as much in their interviews from that time. Being told you're good, but you're not that good. For a lot of manufactured acts, that resentment never fades, and the group becomes a waiting room. You do your time, you collect your fans, and everyone tries to bet on which one is going to strike out on their own and leave the other members in the dust. All the while, you in the group are hoping and praying that that person is you. What's unusual about Little Mix is that they didn't succumb to that pressure or that trope. Once they started rehearsing and performing together, they saw a collective vision. Little Mix was a project, and they wanted to make it work as equal creative partners. Their first number one hit following their X Factor song was a solo written number called Wings about their rise to stardom. They talked excitedly in interviews about how much they loved making music, creating videos, and working together. There was also an instant push and pull between them and their label. You can tell that they're intentionally building something together instead of resentfully holding the consolation prize for failed soloists and biding their time. This mindset shift is exactly why they lasted for so long. 10 years is a century in girl group time, almost unheard of. It wasn't easy for them to last that long. They had to actively resist the industry and the public's investment in the breakout star narrative. Perry was definitely anointed as the one who should go solo after she was engaged to Zayn Malik, but she was never tempted to stray because their internal missions aligned. Either the group succeeds or none of us do. I can imagine that the solo fantasy when you're in that group never disappears entirely, especially when you didn't originally want to be in a group, but it's not the organizing principle of the girls while they're together. The engine of their story is us against the world, not me against these other girls. For a manufactured group, that is a rare dynamic to stumble upon. Every year that Coachella rolls around, something amazing but inconvenient happens to me. I discover there are like 5 artists that I must see as soon as possible. On my list right now are Slater and Pink Pantherus. This epiphany is amazing because who doesn't love live music? But it's inconvenient because getting tickets in this era is like fighting for your goddamn life in the Hunger Games. But it's always amazing and never inconvenient with the sponsor of today's video, the iconic SeatGeek. I love using SeatGeek because they turn my wildest dream of actually getting fairly priced tickets to shows I want to see at my convenience into a reality. They've got over 70,000 events, concerts, sports, festivals. So whether you're chasing that post-Coachella high or you need a big event to look forward to this summer, it is all there for you. And the best part is the app literally tells you if you're getting a good deal. Tickets are rated 1 through 10. So you just look for the green dots. Green is good. Red is, we're not doing that right now. And plus, every ticket is backed by their buyer guarantee. So you're not gambling on some sketchy resale. SeatGeek has got you covered from start to finish. And of course, I have a code for you guys. You can use code SwiftOlogist10 for 10% off your next set of tickets on SeatGeek. That's 10% off any tickets with promo code SwiftOlogist10. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so that you can use it later. Coachella might be over, but your live music era is just getting started. Thank you, SeatGeek. Let's compare this to another girl group that doesn't quite fit the entirely, you know, created authentically versus manufactured in a lab narrative either. The Spice Girls are a halfway point between product and band. They started as a management experiment, a newspaper ad, an audition process, a bunch of girls in a room being tested for chemistry. And even though they were formed and selected by someone else, they developed an interpersonal bond and decided that their current manager wasn't cutting it for their aspirations. And so they fired him, took their songs with them, and spent a critical period of time just managing themselves. Here, they got aligned on the mission. Girl power was more than a slogan or even a moral compass to them. It was a business imperative. The 5 of them aligned for a while around the idea that the group was the mission, and the men who assembled them were merely disposable actors in their play. What's kind of interesting about the Spice Girls is that even though they were very unified at the beginning, they're also the most cartoonishly individualized girl group we've ever had. Scary, sporty, baby, ginger, posh, five archetypes in different colored knee-high boots. The group was definitely not about cohesion. Every poster, doll, and magazine spread is telling you that each Spice Girl is a standalone character. You don't just like the Spice Girls, you are one of them. That's brilliant marketing, but it's also a slow-burning solo campaign. When your identity is that distinct, the question of are you gonna go solo isn't an if, but a when. As an aside, what's kind of interesting is how their subsequent lives in the public eye have resembled their group's archetypes. Need I point out the irony of Victoria Beckham Posh Spice becoming a fashion designer? Little Mix and the Spice Girls are both manufactured, but their missions are different to begin with. Little Mix are told they're not strong enough on their own and they choose the group as their dream. The Spice Girls are told they're part of a concept and then they decide briefly to own that concept themselves. In both cases, there's at least a period where the women feel they are the project, not merely its employees. That doesn't save them forever, but it buys them time, and it's no coincidence that these are two of the most successful girl groups of all time. Unfortunately, Cat's Eye doesn't get that luxury. The Hybe experiment starts from the opposite premise. The concept existed before the girls did. The label spent years designing this global girl group in a PowerPoint and then goes looking for bodies to populate their deliverables. The survival show is very explicit about this. You're not watching six friends pull a band out of thin air. This is a casting process. The girls aren't asked during the show what they'd like to say together as a group. They're not asked anything at all. The executives deliberate in boardrooms about who fits, who tests well, who survives this round. When your group is created under those conditions, your job is not to form an equal partnership with five other girls. Your job is to win, to outlast, and to be the one who gets the slot. Any real friendship that happens is almost incidental. The system would like it if you would bond, because that's good TV and good marketing, but it doesn't actually depend on you making a collective decision about your mission the way Little Mix or early Spice Girls did. If anything, a strong internal alliance that resists the company's plans is a problem to be managed. Little Mix were constantly having rows with their label. They were a pain in the ass because they refused to just let their entire career be orchestrated by the men with ideas in suits. They were unified in their purpose, and so they could band together and have some leverage with their creative disagreements. They could at least express their discomfort with the decisions being made on their behalf and somewhat be taken seriously because they had the potential to stop the work. It's pretty obvious why labels don't foster union in groups. It's much easier to divide and conquer when every person believes they are replaceable. This is why everyone's original intent when going into a group matters so much to the eventual success of the group. If you think you've joined a band, you behave one way. You compromise, subsume your ego, swallow the weirdness that maybe occasionally rises up between a bunch of people trying to work together, because the group is the dream that you're all working towards. But if you've landed a role on a show, you behave in a different way. You have one eye on the prize and one eye on the exit. Label build groups, especially survival show groups, are designed to encourage the second mindset while selling the first mindset to the consumer. The show told Manon and us that she had found her five best friends and a lifelong mission, and her dream was coming true. The structure she was actually inside, though, clearly viewed her as a role that could be recast or written out if the experiment demanded it. And when you situate Cat's Eye inside the longer tradition of how girl groups come together and fall apart, it's easier to tell which myth is going to win, the friendship myth or the myth of the breakout star. Before we get into specific girl group disasters and how they mirror Cat's Eye, I want to give you a simple framework for how I'm thinking about girl groups here. These are the deeper roles that each woman ultimately plays in the story. I'm going beyond main dancer and lead singer here purposely. This is just my opinion as an observer and a fan of girl groups for years. You can disagree or fiddle around with the definitions if you please. But I think in the most heavily managed girl groups, you can reliably spot five archetypes. First of all is the protagonist. This is the narrative center of the group. The one who the camera falls in love with, the voice you hear the most, the obvious solo candidate. If there's going to be a breakout star, it's her, and it's obviously her from the start. Then you have the leader or the proxy. She's our responsible one. Maybe she speaks more in interviews. She stays on message and usually aligns with the management's vision for the group. Then you have the wild card or the visionary. This is the chaos agent. She's outspoken, creatively restless, or, you know, maybe just presented that way. She makes things interesting and unpredictable, which is great for TV and performance, but much less great for the people trying to keep the machine on schedule. The most important part of any girl group, though, is not the star or the wild card. It's the glue and the workhorse. She is the stabilizer. She's doing the harmony. She's cleaning up the choreo. She's mediating arguments. She's showing up prepared to every rehearsal. She might not be the headline name or the breakout star, but the group would fall into disarray without her organizing principle. And then we have the visual outlier. This is the face, the it girl, or the member who kind of sits at the edge of the group. Maybe, usually, she's the only Black member, the foreign member, the one whose look is most exotic compared to her sisters that stand around her. She sells fantasy and representation, and she is often the most structurally vulnerable. The visual or the outlier and the protagonist are different because the visual or the outlier isn't necessarily the main star of the group, but she could be the face of the group. I hope that makes sense. I'll return again to Little Mix. Now, Now, the archetypes are a little bit more evenly distributed here, but the pattern, I think, remains. Perry and Jade are the obvious vocal protagonists. Their ad-libs and their belts are all over the singles, but Jade and Leanne do a huge amount of glue and the visionary work, writing songs, harmonies, and helping with the choreography, and they definitely keep the group's creative vision alive, progressively becoming more involved in production and songwriting as the group matures. Leanne, like many Black girls, has to play multiple roles at the same time within the group. She is the glue, the visionary, and the outlier. She's subjected to a certain kind of racial abuse that doesn't burden her fellow bandmates, and she feels something that other Black women in her position have often felt too, like the fans care less about her than her lighter group members. This is something Normani has talked about multiple times in Fifth Harmony. Leanne isn't the only outlier in Little Mix, though. I think she's often overlooked as an outlier because Jessie Nelson is the outlier. Due to her body image and her mental health issues, as well as the fact that she is larger than her stick-thin bandmates, that outlier narrative definitely carries on into her messy departure from the group, which we will discuss later. If you want a really clear vision of a protagonist, look at Fifth Harmony. Camila Cabello was positioned there immediately, centered in choruses, allowed to do all these external collaborations while she was in the group, and treated very much by the public and the label as a likely solo star. Ali and Normani occupy that leader glue hybrid role. They're professional, they don't pull focus, they carry a lot of responsibility. Lauren is kind of the wild card. She's visibly conflicted about the group's image, and she's a lot more political and sometimes painted as difficult compared to the other girls. Now, the Pussycat Dolls are an extreme case of the archetypes. Nicole Scherzinger is basically everything in this group. She's definitely the protagonist and the leader. The group is built around her vocals and her image. The other dolls are merely backup dancers. Can you name one of them? First and last name? Probably not, because they are intentionally excluded from the group's story. When all this reunion drama is happening, like right now, it's about who gets to orbit Nicole and on what terms, not about five or six equal sisters negotiating their comeback. Now let's look at the archetypes for Cat's Eye. This project is intentionally not as blatant about selecting a star as something like the Pussycat Dolls or Fifth Harmony was, because the whole gimmick of Cat's Eye is that this is a democratic global supergroup that you helped form. So there basically is no protagonist. What we do have here is a very clear wild card and outlier. Manon is both. I'm not going to deep dive into each of these cases yet, that will come later on, but for now, I just want you to hold on to this idea of these archetypes when you think about any girl group that you love. Ask yourself, who's the main character? Who's responsible? Who's chaotic? Who does the camera love to single out? Understanding the roles that group members occupy is the first step to demystifying the invisible politics that unfold on stage. Okay, so now that we understand how girl groups are cast, let's discuss the myth of sisterhood that pervades every new entity. We are told from day one that these girls, no matter who they are best friends. It's the first story anyone ever sells you about a group. Before we see a writing credit or we hear a song, we see social media content of them maybe lounging on a couch together, making each other laugh, doing silly challenges. This is especially intense for groups formed on TV because there is that reality television element. The entire narrative spine of shows like The X Factor or Popstar Academy is that these strangers meet in that pressure cooker and in record time become a family. The girls themselves will repeat this narrative in interviews, partly because they mean it at that point and partly because they've just been handed the role of best friend to sell. For marketing purposes, you cannot just be six talented coworkers. You have to be soulmates. That's the parasocial investment that the audience buys into. This justifies the fandom's labor. People will buy 10 copies of an album, stream a song overnight, translate every interview for free if they think that they're helping their girls protect a holy bond. But that holy bond is 100% nonsense. These are co-workers and they have met under difficult conditions. Sure, they can be friends, but they have met at work. They didn't choose each other. A casting team chose them. They are teenagers and young women who are constantly being filmed and evaluated and prompted to prioritize this job above sleep, privacy, and their own instincts. Of course, some of them become genuinely close and those bonds are real, but the system that they're in is not built to nurture long-term friendship. It's built to generate content by any means necessary. The fans' expectations of their friendship is frankly deranged. Think about what you're actually requesting. Four, five, or even six young women randomly plucked from different countries and cultures are told to live and work on top of each other for years. They're often underpaid, exhausted, overworked, financially entangled, and under persistent surveillance. In any normal job, we would just call them colleagues and accept that some of those divas are going to click and some of them will tolerate each other. Some of them will loathe each other and just get on with it because there is work to do. That's life. But girl groups aren't allowed that level of humanity. There's a curtain that exists that you can't look behind. They're expected to be coworkers, roommates, business partners, trauma buddies, and literal best friends, all at once with no breaks and no privacy. That is a social experiment. That is not a friendship. And it's a gendered social experiment to boot. Boy bands have way more latitude to be messy. In fact, being messy and squabbling with each other is practically part of the job description. The rock star cliche of trashing hotel rooms and sleeping with groupies and fighting backstage and storming off tours, those stories become part of the brand. It's wild and uncontrollable. Boys will be boys' behavior. When a guy in a band rolls his eyes in an interview or storms out of a press junket, it's funny or iconic or proof that he's real. When a girl group member does the bare minimum version version of that. Perhaps she looks away during a photo op or doesn't sing along to one lyric, sits slightly apart from a member that the internet has invented she's feuding with. You get 10-minute YouTube conspiracies titled, Do They Secretly Hate Each Other? Fifth Harmony lived through this in real time. Every awkward moment, stiff hug, and mismatched facial expression was turned into content. Compilations with millions of views about how the group always hated Camila and how the other four were bullying her, or depending on the ship of the week, how they were obsessed with her. Fans scrubbed through hours of footage to catch micro expressions, someone not clapping fast enough or turning away too quickly, to read it as evidence of a deep moral failure. The failure to look after your sisters and buy into the sisterhood wholeheartedly. Meanwhile, in Fifth Harmony specifically, there were deeper issues going on in that group that needed careful discussion, the racist abuse that Normani received, and Camila's part in facilitating that. And yet, all anyone ever wanted to talk about, did she just roll her eyes? Ladies and gentlemen, gays and theys, these are respectability politics. It's not enough for these women to do their jobs of delivering iconic music and moments. They have to be nice about it, sweet and grateful and supportive of themselves and each other. They can never show that they're irritated or admit that they might be jealous or resentful or bored. This is a tale as old as time. Moody and distant boy band members are tortured artists. And when a woman in a group is anything less than sunshine, she's unprofessional, a diva, or a snake. Boo! This double standard creates a constant low-grade panic inside the girl groups themselves. If any friction becomes a scandal, you would learn as a member very quickly that you are not allowed to have a normal human conflict. You can't just say, she was annoying me that day, or we're actually not that close, we're just doing our jobs, without detonating a crisis and potentially ruining the group. So you have to swallow it. You lie and insist that you're all best friends while building up years of resentment or dissociating or shutting down. There's no incentive for anyone to take that pressure off of the girls in the girl group because the friendship myth sells the group. In fact, when that pressure manifests into negative attention towards one particular member of the group, there's big business in poking holes in the myth. Girl group body language analysis is a huge thing. Gossip accounts and tea channels are constantly keeping track of who unfollowed who didn't like whose Instagram post, and who stood a little too far away in a group photo. That content feeds the algorithm and boosts streams and keeps fan cams circulating. Labels know this. Reality shows know this. They absolutely understand that if they can make you both believe in and doubt the friendship, if they can introduce the idea that one girl is letting the others down, you will watch every frame more closely and talk about it more online. That's free marketing. It's also an incredibly efficient way to remind every member of this group that she is replaceable. If you're a label, the perfect scenario is this. You get all the benefits of the sisterhood story, fans working for free, endless content, a cute feminist veneer, and all the benefits of pitting the girls against each other as competitors. The girls through this process learn that if they step out of line, there's a whole audience ready to recast them as the friend group's villain. It might be Menon today, but it could be Lara tomorrow. Fans will do the disciplining for you because they are so invested in protecting this idealized best friendship sisterhood that they've been sold. If things really go south behind the scenes and the dynamic is untenable and someone has to go, the label can always reframe it as the personal failing of the member who is ejected. One bad apple. She wasn't a team player. She couldn't handle it. She betrayed the sisterhood. This is the final maneuver of the sisterhood myth. When the pressure inevitably cracks someone, it's never treated as evidence that the job might be impossible. It's framed as one girl's personal failure. Now, I want to look at what actually happens when that moment comes, how groups decide who gets cast out as the problem and who gets to stay in the family. I'm going to start with Little Mix and Fifth Harmony because they're the most recent examples who had social media piling on as the groups unraveled, just like Cat's Eye is experiencing during this current speed bump. The archetypes that I mentioned at the outset of this video are not, in fact, rigid. Multiple members can occupy different roles simultaneously, which makes laying the blame more complicated when we autopsy the death of a girl group. It's very tempting to say, oh, Jessie Nelson was the sacrificial lamb, or Camila was the villain, and just call it a day. Earlier on, I laid out the roles that I think Little Mix played and showed you how unusual their structure is. Let's return to the outliers of that group because they are the most vulnerable for sacrifice always in any situation, Leanne and Jessie. Both of them have at different points been in Menon's shoes. On paper, Jessie is the stereotypical sacrificial lamb. The group's official story is 10 years of we're sisters, we're each other's rocks, we can't imagine doing this without each other. And then Jessie leaves, saying she felt completely alone, humiliated by social media, and trapped in a job she believed was killing her. That sits uneasily next to the group's own account of what went down. Leanne and Jade have both said that they tried to support her, that Jessie had every support system available, and that her decision to leave when and how she did, via her management and her lawyers, in the middle of an album cycle, felt very abrupt and painful for them. But then there's everything that happened after Jessie left. In her 2026 docuseries and interviews, Jessie claims another member of Little Mix actually wanted to leave the group years before she did, and that it was never her decision to leave first. She felt heartbroken when that specific member pulled back from the idea, and she hints pretty obviously that this member was Leanne. She admits that she probably didn't handle it very well, and that she panicked about the band ending spending and couldn't give the person that support they needed at the time. That complicates the popular narrative of Jessie as the one who betrayed the sisterhood or was betrayed by the sisterhood. At the same time, the way that she launched her solo career with Boys, the Nicki Minaj feature, and a full-blown blackfishing scandal means she's not the perfect sacrificial lamb. She's neither 100% to blame for getting kicked out nor for not being able to stay in. Leanne and Jessie had apparently discussed blackfishing while they were still in the group. So who's the victim and who's the villain here? Who's the sacrificial lamb? Jessie, who broke under the pressure and left, or Leanne, who gets painted as both hater and diva in both instances of Jessie's departure story? The sacrifice is distributed between them because it actually doesn't matter who the bad apple was. We just need something or someone to blame that is not the underlying conditions that made staying in this group unsustainable. Fifth Harmony has a different story. Here, the sacrifice isn't a girl being squeezed out. It's a girl refusing to stick around long enough to be sacrificed at all. Camila Cabello, Fifth Harmony's protagonist, is front and center 24/7. She gets the best ad libs, the best parts in all the songs, and the most opportunities to expand her solo career while she's actually still in the group. The rest of the group isn't idiots. They can see who the label is quietly pushing, and there's a lot of internal strife about how unfair line distribution is on songs, for example. But by the end of their tenure as a group, you have Camila completely distancing herself from group activities, basically operating as a solo agent while pretending to be in the group, writing songs for herself, and actively scheming to get free from their restrictive contract with her own team of lawyers while the other girls act collectively as a whole. From the other four girls' perspective, this is a PR and business nightmare. They knew they needed the Fifth Harmony brand to be bigger and more solid if all five of them were going to have a decent chance at having solo prospects. This was, keep in mind, the second album that they released. The only person who had become a real star at this point was Camila Cabello. So in that context, Camila leaving when she did wasn't just a personal choice, it was an economic one. She tapped out of the girl group project early on and said very clearly, "I'm going to make the most of the fact that I'm the star. I don't care what happens to the rest of you." And it worked. She became the big solo act the structure had always been priming her to be. Is she the villain? Not really. She's following the logic the industry laid out for her, going into that second myth. You're the protagonist. You're the star. You can have a body of work outside of this group. If you want creative control, you need to leave and do it your own way. At the same time, though, imagine if you're Normani. You're wildly talented, heavily underutilized, and facing racist double standards in the group and from the fandom, or any of the other members of the group. Suddenly, you're just a supporting player in someone else's origin story. In this case, the sacrifice is the entire project of Fifth Harmony as a sustainable entity. Once Camila exits without a protagonist, the group's attempt to rebrand as a more equal four never really takes. They manage one more era and then they dissolve. Destiny's Child and the Pussycat Dolls aren't the most handy case studies for this particular video because they are both so reliant on the star power of the protagonist. Pretty much every member got left to their own devices or was forcibly relegated to a backing role. However, I would like to point you in the direction of a group that isn't similar to Cat's Eye in sound, performance, style, or styling, but shares a spiritual element with them, the lack of having a stable protagonist archetype at all. I'm talking about the Sugar Babes. If you're not from or adjacent to the UK, you might only know their name vaguely, but in the 2000s, they were one of the major British girl groups. Three teenagers who went from slightly off-kilter R&B into pure pop, racking up a whole string of hits. On the surface, theirs is a straightforward, maybe a little bit chaotic success story, but underneath, they are a great example of what happens when a label decides that the group is the star and everyone inside it can theoretically be swapped out. The first lineup was Mutia, Keisha, and Siobhan. Siobhan leaves in 2001 and Heidi steps in. A few years later, Mutia leaves and ML takes her place. On paper, nothing is broken. The name still stays the same, the singles are charting, and for a while, the public kind of just rolls with each new iteration of the trio. The machine is proving a ruthless point here. In a three-member group, you can rotate two whole people around a single constant, and most average listeners will still accept Sugar Babes as the same brand. So who is this constant that the group is revolving around? Keisha. She's there from the very beginning until 2009. Vocally and narratively, she is the protagonist, the one voice and face that runs through every era, even as management treats her as though she is just another moving part, which was a big mistake on their behalf. She's also the only dark-skinned black member for most of that run, which is fundamental to how the industry and the press talk about her when things get tense in the group dynamics. When she's pushed out of the group by management, the familiar racialized script kicks in, stories about her bullying her group members and her being the problem and the other girls needing to be protected from her. Meanwhile, none of those other girls had been Sugar Babes from the beginning. In 2020, Keisha finally said out loud that being stereotyped by the label and the press as the angry black woman as an excuse to kick her out of the Sugar Babes is trauma that she's still in therapy for. She says that the disagreements that she had with her band members were normal teenage arguments being written up to make her look aggressive, and the coverage was always in favor of the white girls. She felt she was a scapegoat and collateral when the label wanted to change the lineup because she wasn't going along with their creative direction. So, in other words, the protagonist holding the group together was recast as the outlier and the problem when it suited the powers that be. Given the existing offensive stereotypes about dark-skinned black women, she was easy to throw under the bus when the brand needed to move on. What the label and management underestimated is how much of the audience's attachment ran through Keisha when they finally pushed her out in 2009 and carried on with this fourth lineup that had no original members of the group at all. The spell broke. The records flopped. The public lost interest. It didn't even seem like it was the Sugar Babes anymore. They were able to rotate people in and out around one woman for years until they crossed an invisible line where the group had become a franchise with no soul. At that point, the project fizzled and the founding trio eventually now has had to fight to reclaim the name and reattach it to actual human beings. They're slaying now, by the way, and their journey back to each other is a real story of sisterhood. What's happening with Cat's Eye is the same logic. Because these girls were cast in someone else's story, the name and the concept are bigger than any individual girl. So you can always swap someone out and keep the experiment running. This video has mostly discussed the structure of Western girl groups. To really understand what's happening with Manon and Cat's Eye, we have to add one final ingredient to that, the design of the K-pop idol system. I have an interview with Adela that goes into this in more detail, but let's just do the basics. In the classic idol model, you don't just join a band, you become a trainee to join a band. Your life is contracts and curfews and people weighing you. You live in dorms or company housing, your social circle is mostly other trainees and the staff. Everything about your life is locked down. No social media without permission, no dating, no going out at night. Your image is not yours, and neither is your day-to-day life. Everyone around you, all of your friends, are your competition. Creatively, the hierarchy is just as controlled. Western pop fans are already familiar with the hit factory model in our own version of pop music. Writers like Justin Tranter or Amy Allen flying into sessions, getting a brief from a label, and tailoring songs to an artist or a trend with or without them in the room. But even in that world, there's usually at least the fantasy that the artist and the writer are collaborating in real time, that something honest might slip through just by having the artist at least sit in on the ideating sessions. Fundamentally, I like to believe that songs are stories. They originate from a very human and organic place. The spark of inspiration is the seed of an idea. I don't automatically dismiss songs with many writers on them as inauthentic, so long as the main artist is listed and I can hear a connection between the song and other songs they've created, because I like to believe the spark came from whoever is performing the song. And if it didn't, I hope that that person was involved in fine-tuning the process of executing someone else's spark and tweaking it to make it their own. That's the collaborative process of songwriting for a big pop star. The way the K-pop songwriting sessions go is completely antithetical to everything I personally believe about how music should be made. There is no human process to it. Here's a TikTok recently posted by my op, Justin Tranter, who reveals how clinical, corporate, and totally devoid of the humanity required to make good art the K-pop songwriting process is.
The art of collaboration when working on something in the K-pop system is a very different way of working. You're given from, it's a deep collaboration with the K-pop companies themselves. So you're given very specific briefs of, we want the song to be about this, we want the next single to sound like this, we want the song to represent this feeling, we want it at this BPM, and it's this pretty amazing, long, detailed plan they have for what the next song, the next era, the next feeling needs to be for each group. So, and then when you send a song in, if they like it, you go back and forth and they give you a lot of notes so it can really line up to their long-term vision. And it's not that one way of working is better or worse. It's that you're collaborating in a different, very different way. There's like a deep collaboration with the K-pop executives.
What you can ascertain from this inside scoop is that the executives have decided the concept, the narrative beats, the marketing arc, how the song will play and how it will sound on TikTok and where the song will fit in the group's overall trajectory before the girls even got to look at it. The label is in complete total control of the outcome. I wouldn't even call what Justin Tranter's doing here in this process songwriting. The writers are just there to execute what the suits can't, make it into music. Cat's Eye songs are scenes from someone else's script. How can any of this be perceived as human, let alone genuine artistry? The teams behind your favorite idols exercise much more control than a typical Hollywood management does. They watch like hawks over your personal social media, they mandate live streams on their integrated paid apps like Weverse. Cat's Eye's self-expression outside of the group is just as carefully controlled and storyboarded as what's handed to Justin Tranter to make Pinky up as a prompt. If there's no place for Cat's Eye to express themselves artistically or personally, can we even call them artists? Cat's Eye is an explicit attempt to port the K-pop system into the Western market. Hive and Geffen did not pretend otherwise. Cat's Eye fans love to call them K-pop when it's convenient and not K-pop when it's not, but let's listen to what the group's creators actually have to say about it. In the Netflix doc and in press surrounding it, Bang Si-hyuk and other executives describe the project as an international girl group based on K-pop methodology, and the power dynamic is baked in from that premise. Bang Si-hyuk said he has a rule. He doesn't even meet trainees in person until they debut. He watches them only on screens. The man whose decisions will shape their careers prefers to observe them like characters in a video game. And crucially, the characters here, the Cat's Eye members, did not pick each other. The group didn't form because the girls wanted to be in a band. It formed because two corporations wanted a K-pop style franchise that could operate in English. Manon is definitely the visual outlier of the group. She is 100% considered to be the face. And that is largely why I think she was selected to be in the group. They keep talking over and over in the documentary about how she just has the right look and everything else will follow later. Meanwhile, the other girls are examined a lot more closely on their technical excellence. She also adds a bit of attitude and life into what is otherwise a very manufactured and constructed dynamic. The other girls are very eager to please. Manon has this underlying ambivalence that makes her a very captivating presence. It seems to me from the brief glimpses that we get of her on the show that she has her head on straight. She understands what's actually important to her in her life. She's filmed with her family members much more than the other girls, and she deliberately, at times, skips rehearsals to try and recharge her energy by spending time with them. In the context of the show, this is portrayed as a grave error. How dare you betray the group to nurture yourself? You must not want it bad enough. Perhaps, instead of villainizing that, we should examine the system that expects you to completely sublimate your most basic human desires, to be close with your family, to rest, to feel happy and fulfilled while doing your job, in service of starring in someone else's video game. Manon's story providing this ambivalence and the way that the girls respond to it drives what would otherwise be a very boring show about girls who will do anything, whatever it takes, to get into a group. She also, separate to all of this, happens to just be a star. No one can deny she is the perfect face of the group. She's perfect television, but a terrifying long-term employee, because there are bigger things in life that are more important to her than being in Cat's Eye. For the system she's in, she is a structural liability. Idol logic doesn't know what to do with visible ambivalence. It can only reward the member who will cry on cue about how this is her one dream and she'll die for it, not the member who sometimes looks like she'd rather go home. And thus, it's no surprise to me that Manon's tenure in Cat's Eye was short-lived. When HYBE announced that Manon will be taking that temporary hiatus from the group to focus on her well-being, the wording is familiar to anyone who has followed K-pop before. To stop fans from having a full-on meltdown about someone permanently leaving, and also to leave the door open in case they can reel her back in, nothing here is said about what actually drove this decision. Was it internal dynamics? Was it creative differences? Was it structural pressure? Within weeks, Cat's Eye are performing again as a five-piece at Coachella and releasing a new song, announcing an EP with Manon unmentioned. Fans who watched every episode of the documentary and every behind-the-scenes vlog are left to connect the dots themselves. What was the turning point that either forced her or made her want to leave? Here's my personal take on this. I think Manon likely feels very free now to do whatever she wants outside of this punishing framework. I can't imagine the process of being in a group like Cat's Eye with all of its expectations, where you are basically just a doll that gets posed this way and that way, is enjoyable to anyone who isn't totally under the spell of the label and the management. Her rightful ambivalence towards giving up her entire youth for someone else's experiment will ultimately save her from this momentary crushing feeling of missing her shot. Unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever hear directly from her, though, about what happened, because inside this idol framework, she has almost no space to answer. Those NDAs are no joke. They will sue you. She can't go on YouTube and do a 40-minute tell-all with Alex Cooper. She can't sit down to discuss contract clauses and power imbalances. The only people that are allowed to speak officially about what's gone on are the company and the group accounts that it controls. The other girls in this group, who also might have something that they would like to say about this, are still under contract and under scrutiny and very aware of what happens to people who step out of line. I bet this entire exercise was a very scary reminder to all of them that they can be replaced at any time. This K-pop style global girl group machinery removes even the illusion that the girls at its center are co-authors of how decisions are made, let alone who gets to stay in the group. In Little Mix, there was at least some sense that Jessie and the others negotiated, fought, and tried to reshape their working conditions while still working together before ultimately falling apart for unrelated reasons. Because they had more creative control over their project, they could say no to things and create obstacles to more work getting done, which meant the label and their management simply had to negotiate with them and treat them like partners in the brand instead of employees. That just isn't the reality for Cat's Eye. Every person in that group is there for a reason, because the label needs something from them. Let's also call a spade. This project needed a Black girl, not just any member, but a visibly Black, Western-coded girl who could tick the global diversity box and embody a certain idea of cool, while making the whole experiment more palatable to Western audiences who have traditionally, if you're not really into the K-pop thing, thought of it as corny. Manon happened to be able to provide them all of those things and more. She was magnetic on camera, instantly recognizable, someone you could definitely build a whole narrative around. You would think from the way that people are behaving about Manon leaving the group that she was 100% the protagonist, but she was the outlier and the wild card. The group is continuing successfully without her, and that reveals a more sinister truth about this project. HYBE won't pick a protagonist because they want replaceable girls. If they have an obvious star carrying everything, vocals, dancing, interviews, that person has more leverage than the other girls, and it would be too hard to recast her. And so I think that each girl in Cat's Eye is reduced in their abilities or kept away from doing the thing they're really good at. This is why we don't really hear Lara or Sophia leading vocals or even being given songs that can display those vocals to begin with. And it's why Dani only gets the occasional opportunity to really show off her dancing skills. A too bright star would become too important. This is also why they keep them quiet on their personal social media profiles and refuse to let them develop personal brands. They want you, the listener, invested in the idea of Cat's Eye, not in each member's unique personality, a la the Spice Girls. The Sugar Babes showed us that labels will happily treat a girl as a revolving door if the logo keeps selling, and the idol system imported into the Western market turns that attitude into a workflow. The roles are cast, the arcs are planned, and difficult exits are simply par for the course. Mark my words, this won't be the first personnel change in Cat's Eye's tenure. Because they are a cast, not a band. The girls are immensely talented, but as I said, they are not artists. They don't originate the vision or make any decisions about the music or their own story. Their mission from day one is to play their part and survive the process. The process relies on boxing them into just one of the archetypes we've discussed today, the workhorse. All of these girls are workhorses. By making each of them a workhorse, they are reducing their risk profiles. They've been very intentional about not having a protagonist from the beginning. In Act 1 of Cat's Eye, they needed Manon to take on the role of the face of the group, but they couldn't let her become the star, so she was often shoved to the back of the choreography. Can you see why they did that? As the consumer, we need to have an iconic visual to remember about a group, an unforgettable face. We got that from Manon for Cat's Eye. Plus, she was the interesting, dramatic hook of the group, the only source of tension on the show. And so when the group debuted and there was nothing to write about, that was the thing that they could write about, the fact that there was a person in the group who almost didn't make it. You'll notice from every comeback single and video, the group successfully rotates its center of attention as its visibility has increased to avoid anointing any single protagonist. We obviously don't know what happened, but here's an educated guess. Manon wants something different for her life than whatever Cat's Eye is offering. This is reasonable in any other working environment, but asking the system to change its ways is the surest way to get kicked out of it. Perhaps she said, I don't want to live this way. I don't want to have this schedule. And they said, okay, instead of changing the schedule, you get out of the group. The friendship myth hurts the girls and Manon as they transition into this new era of Cat's Eye. It provides the classic convenient excuse for her departure. When you've been sold a story about sisters who will spend the rest of their lives together, any fracture has to be explained away as one girl's failure. The narrative gravity is pulling towards Manon couldn't handle this or Manon didn't want it enough, instead of exploring an alternative story, which could be that perhaps the way that this job is being laid out to these girls is not healthy in the way that it's currently structured. They'll do anything but encourage people to ponder that possibility. A lot of people will just say, that's what girl groups are like, but do they have to be like this? We've had glimpses of other possibilities, the Spice Girls firing their management and taking their business elsewhere, Little Mix digging their heels in with their label and insisting on writing songs even when it made them difficult, the founding Sugar Babes fighting a legal battle to reclaim their name. These are modest acts of resistance, but they point towards a version of the industry where girl groups can be honest about being co-workers, where their power is shared more evenly, and where going solo isn't the only route to self-preservation. I know for a fact from a few reliable sources that multiple labels are already cooking up their own Cat's Eye style experiments. Of course they are. If you're an executive watching from a boardroom, the lesson of Cat's Eye isn't, maybe we're exerting too much control over these girls. It's, we can do that too, and maybe we can do it cheaper. More idol training camps, more survival shows, more storyboards sent to songwriters, more global groups where the members are interchangeable and my pockets are fat. As a fan and as someone who loves pop music, I think importing this K-pop sensibility into Western pop as a group system is a disaster, not just ethically, but artistically. The whole point of art is that it lets you feel something true that you couldn't quite get to on your own. When you turn girl groups into lab experiments and you cast them on television, you storyboard their friendships and you pre-write their personal songs and you design every measure of their career in a conference room, what you're doing is you're sanding off the weirdness and specificity that makes pop great in the first place. Yeah, you get perfect choreography and dead-eyed performances, you get a lot of content, pinky up and internet girl instead of say my name and shout out to my ex. I implore you, we don't have to accept that. We can stop rewarding companies for building groups as products first and people second. We can, at the very least, notice when the same kinds of girls are being pushed into the same sacrificial roles over and over again and refuse to pretend that it's bad luck or direct all of our hatred and anger about the unfairness of it on the remaining group members who don't have a say. Don't stream these god-awful songs. Keep directing your rage at the people who are responsible for making them, which obviously, can I remind you, is not the girls involved themselves. As Adela would say, yell at the machine, girl. All right, that is my diatribe about the politics of being in a girl group. What did you guys think of this video? Is there anything I missed out? Is there a girl group case study you think that is interesting that I didn't include? I would love to hear from you in the comments below.